RadioInfluence.com. The future is now.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Monday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums and Miss
Beans.
Mrs.
Beans.
Ms. What was the difference between Mrs., Miss, and Ms. again? There used to be a Ms. in there, right?
Yeah, Ms. was when you didn't want people to know what you were. It was like a secret.
It was like,
is she married? Is she not?
Is she relationship neutral?
Yes. And then Miss was when you're not married, and Mrs. is when you are.
Gotcha. I remember Ms. was in my life very briefly in school.
Yes.
When we were doing all the titles, but
Ms.
We have a good one today, don't we?
Oh yeah, we do. And everybody get your popcorn ready, sit down, get a nice cup of coffee, whatever you're going to do, snuggle up, because we have Svetlana Lakova with us for about an hour and a half explaining the entire story of what happened to her. Now, she's got a lot more information and we're going to have her back again to talk about it. But this is, I don't think there's been ever an interview this long with her before anywhere that I could find.
I don't think so. And to be honest, as I was listening to her speak about this at great length, it was just one of those moments for me again, where it seems no matter what person, what character in this Russia story, this sedition plot, this treasonous plot that we look at, no matter what character you examine, they become yet another way to disprove the entire thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she has so clearly been turned into a prop, and everything disproves the story. No matter who you talk to, everything disproves the story. It is the war. It was sold on such shit.
It sure was. And you know, this is really the cornerstone of everything, basically. So I would definitely listen to this interview. And if you want to pre-order her book, which will be out very soon, the link to do so is in the show notes, along with a link to a GoFundMe for her legal expenses. She is suing Stefan Halper right now. We didn't even get to start talking about that lawsuit, but she is. And so there's that. But without further ado, Frank, because people are going to be with us a long time today, here's the interview. So we are blessed to be here with Svetlana Lakova, who has a very interesting role in this entire story, specifically how it pertains to General Michael Flynn. But I wanted to give you, Svetlana, and thanks for joining us today, the opportunity to tell this story from the beginning with as much or as little detail as you would feel comfortable with. But there's a lot going on here. So thanks for joining us this morning.
Hello, Tracy, and thank you so much for having me. We've been trying, of course, to organize this for a very long time because your audience has been, you know, asking for us to connect. And it was great that, you know, you and I met at the CPAC recently and finally get the chance to discuss this really important story.
Agreed. And you know, Frank's been following along with me and we've been, you know, keeping tabs on this. We spoke about you. Gosh, Frank, it was a long time ago when you first started speaking out. So in your words, start, I guess, in 2014 with the dinner. Give us a little bit about your background, too, in case people don't know.
Sure. So, well, my name is Svetlana Lakova. As you can judge by my name, I was originally from Russia, born in Moscow. I immigrated to England aged at the tender age of 18. So I'm now going to reveal my age. So I've been living in Britain for 20 years. I'm a British subject. And I upon arrival at Britain, I enrolled at University of Cambridge in England, which is one of the top universities in the world to study history. And I studied history for a number of years under a gentleman called Professor Christopher Andrew. Professor Christopher Andrew is a very senior academic. He was the chair of the history faculty at Cambridge. He's also a very eminent historian, and he specializes in the study of intelligence. So that's not current stuff, but it's intelligence history. So anything starting from, you know, First World War onwards, really. And so in my third year at university, Professor Christopher Enju invited me to join his course called The Secret World, which is the history of intelligence. And a bunch of us signed up because, of course, it was the most exciting course at Cambridge University. And, you know, I was quite successful at that course. So he invited me to continue my postgraduate studies with him and do a master's in the same field. And that coincided with the fact that Soviet archives became open, or some of them became open, following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so he asked me, because I'm a Russian speaker, he asked me to look at the newly opened Soviet archives and help him to translate, because you know, he doesn't read Russian. And in the process, I also wrote a master thesis on the origins of Soviet security services at Cambridge University. So that's my background. I'm a scholar who specializes in very early history of Soviet security services and Western security services.
So you were actually you were part of Project Venona?
Well, I wasn't actually part of that project, but I've done quite a bit of work on it. And in fact, people from the NSA came to Cambridge, and I've assisted them. Even today, although lots of, you know, the codes have been broken, but there was some information they were still interested in, and I've assisted Elizabeth on that as well.
Wow.
So I wasn't part of that project, because that was an American project and it was kind of early on. But it's something that actually, in my own research, I've used extensively.
Wow. Okay, continue, please.
Sure. So you know, I was leading a relatively boring life, very interesting for me, but probably not for many other people, where I was at Cambridge University. I was writing by that stage my PhD dissertation, I was part of a group as well, a study group at Cambridge called Cambridge Intelligence Seminar. So Cambridge Intelligence Seminar is something that was set up by my mentor, Professor Christopher Enju, for students who specialize in intelligence history, like myself. And I attended it since I was 18. We used to meet every Friday, and people would bring, you know, whatever documents they were working on in the archives, and we will discuss our research every Friday night at 5:30. And Christopher Enju was a co-convener of this seminar, and there were two other people whose names are going to be very important to the story later on. So it was somebody called Professor Stefan Halper, and also Sir Richard Dearlove. Sir Richard Dearlove was a former head of MI6, which is the British equivalent of CIA, and he's known as C if you watch James Bond. And he ended up, after his retirement, he got an honorary position at Cambridge University as it's traditional, and he was one of the co-conveners of our seminar. And then this third person, so first person was Christopher Enju, second person was Dearlove, and the third person was then known to me as Professor Stefan Halper, who was positioned to us, you know, described to us as a American, you know, historian, but somebody who previously worked in U.S. presidential administrations and who sort of semi-retired to Cambridge University from U.S. And he was teaching American studies, and was just basically somebody who was around. So that was my life, which was, you know, pretty boring academic life.
So how long did Stefan Halper, how long was Stefan Halper in that group while you were? Because you were in it for quite a long time.
Right. So he was there for a very long period of time. I had a break from university, then I came back. But I would say sort of safely, I was perhaps in the room with him. And the group was relatively small. So, you know, our key core group would be 8-10 people, maybe tops. And then periodically, because the seminar was open, you know, it was there was nothing secret about it, right? Because we were looking at historical events. That means that sometimes some seminars would attract a larger crowd. So sometimes as many as like 100 people would come. But majority of the time, there would be like 5 to 8 of us in the room. And so I had the dubious, as now I know, dubious honor of, you know, pretty much sitting next to Stefan Halper every week for a number of years as a part of a small group of about 8 people. Since about 2012. But what's very interesting about that is that Professor Stefan Halper never actually spoken to me at all, which is quite unusual because it was a small group. And also the environment was meant to be very friendly and encouraging, where the elder members of the group are meant to encourage the younger researchers. So that was, he was somebody who was, you know, quite rude to people, a bit obnoxious to put it mildly, and not really build any rapport with students. So one example would be I've managed to make a huge revelation about something in the archives from 1930s, and I was asked to give a presentation about it by Christopher Andrew, and there was actually quite a lot of interest for that talk of mine. And so, you know, there was a lecture hall which was arranged for my talk. And I was very nervous because it was very exciting, you know, research for me, but I wasn't really used to public speaking. And Stefan Halper sat in the front row of my, you know, my lecture, and he spread himself around so nobody else was kind of sitting next to him, and then he demonstratively fell asleep during my lecture.
And were you presenting the postcard?
No, I was actually, well, the postcard is sort of part of it, but I was presenting sort of bigger findings about Stalin's role in the creation of the Soviet security services. So Stalin, of course, is a Soviet ruler in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And I was writing a dissertation about the evolution of Soviet security services. And so Halper managed to sleep through that presentation, but in a very, you know, provocative way. And in academia, that's not how people behave. Even if you're bored, and frankly, a lot of the time you are, you still have to encourage, especially if you're an elder person, but in general, you still have to show respect to fellow academics. And so he snored, and then periodically he'll sort of wake up, shout something about Ruskis, and fall back asleep. So that's the extent. Imagine, so I was in the room with this guy for many years, in a very small group, and that's it. That's my interaction with Stefan Halper.
So, quick question for you about that group. That is, is that the group where Stefan Halper later said that it was infiltrated by Russians?
Right, which is very amusing because Stefan Halper was, as one of co-conveners, he actually was the only person in the group who on numerous occasions actually invited former Russian intelligence figures to speak at the seminar. So although he later, and we'll come to that in the chronology, he will later claim that the seminar has been penetrated by Kremlin and by Russian spies, but actually the only person who ever invited any Russians to the, you know, the Russian intelligence people to the seminar was Stefan Halper himself.
Wow.
Which tells you a lot about Stefan Halper, right?
Sure does. And so during this time, he was obviously on the payroll of the Office of Net Assessment, which we know now from looking backwards, but... So that what year was that lecture where he fell asleep?
Well, so that specific lecture was in either 2000, I think that was 2014. But we now know, of course, Tracy, from the IG report, which, of course, we didn't, you know, we sort of roughly knew, but we didn't realize the scale of this, is that Stefan Halper was also on the payroll of the FBI since 2008. Right.
Yeah.
And that's something which, you know, as a taxpayer, of course, you know, it should be quite concerning, because not only he was being paid by the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment and to the tune of $1 million, but he was also paid by the FBI, and the amount of payments is still redacted, but it looks from the reductions in the IG report that's a very significant, at least six-figure, you know, sum. So he was basically, we now know, you know, no wonder he wasn't interested in my or anyone else's research, because clearly he wasn't actually, you know, being at Cambridge, because because he was an academic. He was in Cambridge because he was a spy.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely insane. And so how, just real quick before we get into the whole dinner where the postcard comes out and all that, how does one get into Cambridge University? I'm sure it's not as easy as just apply. I mean, do you have to know some, how does it work?
Well, first of all, it's number two university in the world, so it's super tough. And unlike America, where you can also get, you know, things like sports scholarships, etc., in Britain it's purely based on your academic credentials. And for me, it was a huge. I mean, for anyone to get into Cambridge is a huge feat. But for me, it was particularly so because remember, up until age 18, I was living in Russia. And my English, I mean, I studied English at school, right? But I've never lived in England, right? So it wasn't my first language at all. And so not only I had to succeed, you know, to a very high level academically, like basically, you know, being straight A student, but also, you know, to apply to Cambridge University from Moscow, which is what I did. I basically had a lot of help from British Council. And these were the days where you didn't have a computer at home. So I had to go to the British Council offices in Moscow. They helped me with my application. But then you also have to do a lot of other stuff. So not only you had to basically be straight A student, but you also had to have outside, you know, talents or interests. So for example, in my case, I was teaching on a voluntary basis. I was teaching kids, you know, on top of, you know, performing academically. And then you have to also pass an interview process because they want someone at university, you know, who would be diverse, who would be basically a good addition. So even if you're brilliant academically, you might still not get in just because they don't feel you're a good fit. So frankly, for me, out of all my life achievements, other than, you know, my daughter, of course, and the book that I recently published, but out of my whole life, this was a huge feat for a foreigner to get into a top British university on purely on merit.
Wow. Pretty amazing. Good for you. I mean, that's incredible. So we're not dealing with somebody here who doesn't have a nice, competent brain in their head is all I'm trying to say. So.
and that's what, you know, you'll hear towards the end of the story why, you know, one of the reasons why I'm so hurt about what has been done to me is because one of the things that Stefan Halper and his crew did is they stripped this away from me. All my achievements and cost me my position at Cambridge University, to which, as you can hear, I'm very, very much attached.
Yeah, no, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And I wanted to get that out there because, you know, some people hear Cambridge and they're like, oh, but they don't really get what goes into getting in there. So I'm glad you shared that with us. Okay. So now you were invited by who to sit at this dinner with Obama's man, Flynn.
Right. Yes. So, well, the first thing happens is that it's, you know, as we discussed, you know, Cambridge is a prestigious university. And so we get a lot of, you know, very important visitors who come. If somebody's in Europe, they will make sure to stop at Cambridge or Oxford. These are the two top universities. And so it's traditional for people to come and give talks to the students and then I was invited on numerous occasions when we had dignitaries addressing Cambridge University. And in my case, I was selected as one of the few people that they wanted to showcase. So to Department of to the American DIA, so American Military Intelligence. So DIA had a long-standing relationship with Cambridge University, where so we have something called so there is a NATO airbase, which is located just outside Cambridge University, about 1 hour. And attached to that, there is an intelligence department. And that's shared with the American military intelligence because that's their base in Europe. And it's basically European NATO, it's NATO Command Center for Europe. And DIA was very keen to have a cooperation with Cambridge University because that was their way of collecting, in effect, you know, useful information, useful intelligence. So it's quite common to have collaborations between, you know, intelligence groups and the academic groups. And DIA So the head of Obama's, then Obama's day, was visiting Europe on a tour. And one of the main stops was in England. And as part of that, he came to give a speech to address Cambridge University. And following that speech, there was a dinner in honor of General Michael Flynn. And this dinner was arranged at least months in advance that I know of, probably even longer. But at least when the invitation came to me, it was 1 month in advance. And the people for that dinner, it was about 12 people, were very carefully selected, both in terms of their reliability, because, of course, this is the head of DIA, right? You want to protect his security, but also in terms of their academic credentials. So basically, Cambridge University wanted to show off their talent to DIA, with whom there was a, they were sponsoring a lot of our work. So they had to choose their people carefully, who they can sort of show off at the dinner. So my name got taken down 1 month before. All of our names were taken 1 month before the dinner, and it was vetted by both DIA itself. So it was the DIA were copied on the emails arranging the dinner, but also, of course, by the British side of things to assure security, just along with any other names at that dinner. And then when dinner actually happened, General Flynn gave a very, very interesting talk, a public talk originally, where he described, the DIA successes in places like Afghanistan. And he was basically just, in effect, advertising what a great organization that is. And it was very inspiring for people. And then he was basically encouraging Cambridge University students to consider, DIA is either place of potential employment or the fact that, Cambridge University should continue its cooperation with the DIA. So that was the sort of theme of the presentation. And then after that, we all went to this, the selected group that was invited. We all, moved from the lecture hall to the dinner. And the details here become very important because although they're minute, but actually they become crucial later on when we move on to the press attacks. So we walked to that to the dinner place, and the dinner was being held in a private house, like a lodge of the master of Pembroke College. So Cambridge University consists of a number of colleges. And each college has its own master, so that it's like the director of college, but it's an honorary position. And each of those masters will have their own accommodation within the college. So Pembroke College the master was Richard Dearlove, so that's the former head of MI6, and within his private lodge, the dinner was set. And it was very beautiful. So there's some photos online of that that I took, which is that, it's all, beautifully carved wooden tables, lovely wine glasses, candlelights. It was a candlelit dinner. And so it was basically all the stops were sort of pulled, everything was done to impress such an important visitor.
Yeah.
So then we sit down for dinner. General Flynn sits on the center of the table on one side, and opposite him sits a host who is Sir Richard Dearlove, and then on both sides of General Flynn there are two other important members of our group, including Christopher Angel on one side, and then I sit on the opposite side of the very big table to General Flynn, but also to the right, so quite removed from him. And the only reason why I had a relatively central place at the table is because I was the only woman. And it's a British tradition that if there's only one woman within a group, then she gets to sit next to the host. So I actually sat the whole dinner next to Richard Dearlove, who is the former head of British Security Services. And the dinner was relatively uneventful in the sense that, the senior people were discussing politics and world events and upcoming, cooperation and collaboration between Cambridge and DIA. Us, the sort of lowly researchers, we just sort of sat there and, waited for if we were asked to speak. And towards the end of the dinner, I was asked to present some of my research. And I've only recently discovered a document, which was fascinating for me and transpired to be for others, where I was working, actually it's now online, but with Joseph Stalin's personal archive. And in that archive, I found a postcard. And the postcard was very interesting because, you know, we obviously used Joseph Stalin being this, you know, very, very important central figure to world history. But actually, when he was a young man, before the revolution won in Russia, he was on the run. He was on the run from the secret police because he was one of the revolutionaries. He was organizing various demonstrations and things like that, and strikes against the government. So he was on the run from the secret police. And as he was escaping, he sent a postcard to his friends to tell them that, you know, he got safely to wherever it is he was to the place where he was hiding from the police. And that's just amazing document because it's in Stalin's handwriting. It's 1912. It's kind of has a bit of a sense of humor in it. It's just, you know, very, very interesting document. And then what's also interesting is that the Tsarist secret police intercepted that document and it ended up in the police archives. But then when the revolution won in 1917, the Bolsheviks took over the Tsarist police archives, and Stalin discovered the postcard that he himself sent previously when, wow, he was on the run to a friend. So it was just this amazing document. So I was asked to show, so I had a digital copy of it on my iPad. I always carry, you know, my research documents on my iPad just to make sure they're safe. And I was asked to show that document to General Flynn. So I passed my iPad to Sir Richard Dearlove because, as I explained, you know, Flynn was sitting quite away from me. So I passed it to Richard Dearlove, and Richard Dearlove got up to pass that iPad to General Flynn. And then they kind of jokingly, you know, sort of pulled the iPad from each other. And then I told the story, you know, as they were looking at the document at both sides of it, I told that story, to the group. And that's it. So that's the extent of my communication with General Flynn. He said that it was a very interesting document. And can I send a copy of it to copying his assistant? I said, sure. And that's it. That's all that happened to dinner, at dinner with General Flynn. And then, of course, after we pause and I'll let you ask your questions, is the dinner itself was very interesting, but actually insignificant. But it's what happens afterwards and what they make of it that becomes a crucial part of the Spygate story.
So crazy, crazy story. Did you ever email General Flynn after that dinner?
Right. So I emailed him this postcard as asked. I also emailed him with, I've taken, I think as I mentioned, I've taken a bunch of photographs at dinner of General Flynn giving a speech. And then as he was on his way out, he was shaking hands with Dearlove and Chris Andrew, and those pictures are online now. I've posted them. And I emailed those pictures as well. So it was a very, very friendly, very great occasion, but kind of very soon forgotten.
So 3 years goes by after that, right?
Right.
And then all of a sudden, have you, before the articles about you started being published, were you paying attention to what was going on over here? And did you start, you know, like, were there any flags raised for you with Dearlove in particular, given what we were hearing about, you know, Christopher Steele, et cetera, so on and so forth?
So what then happens is that, the General Flynn dinner happens in February 2014. Then we find out much later from the press that General Flynn left DIA. It was just in the news. And what was also very interesting at some point is General Flynn becomes, joins the Trump campaign. And in Cambridge, we sort of, you know, as we were following anyone else who's ever come to Cambridge, that was sort of, you know, we sort of heard about that from the news. So that was the extent of our sort of curiosity about this. Then the next thing that happens to me, which becomes, you know, very significant to what happens later, is in January 2016, So that's nearly 2 years after that dinner. I get an invitation to have a private dinner with Professor Halper, Stefan Halper, at my mentor Christopher Andrews' house. And as I've explained at length in the beginning of this interview, Stefan Halper had no interest in me. He had the opportunity to speak to me every week. He never took that opportunity. In fact, he was outright rude to me. And yet here he is wanting to have a private dinner with me and also suddenly shows interest in my research, which mm-hmm. he'd never shown before. So I declined that invitation. But it wasn't because I knew that anything was, you know, going on, any kind of operation was going on. I declined that invitation because he's just a really rude and unpleasant man. And then the next thing that happens is my professor, Christopher Andrew, becomes agitated that I declined that invitation. So this is January 2016. Now, I've known Professor Andrew for nearly 20 years by that stage, and I've never had from him such a reaction, like over what? Over dinner with some, you know, Stefan Halper is a 74-year-old man who's basically, by that stage, he even left Cambridge University. So I couldn't understand why was it at the time that Christopher Andrew reacted in such an aggressive way towards me, which was completely out of character. But I just basically thought that maybe he was just, you know, just basically got out of bed on the wrong side or something like that, right? I couldn't explain it, so I just, you know, I just forgot it, right? And just moved on with my life. What also happened again, and it then later became to make sense to me, but I didn't understand that at the time, is Christopher Andrew and I were co-writing a book, because during my research period, as I was writing my PhD, I came across an amazing story about Soviet espionage in 1930s in America. And I found this material in the research, which nobody in the archives, which nobody found before. And Christopher Andrew was really excited about that. And he offered me to write a book with him, which was a huge honor, because usually, you know, just a lowly researcher, and here you are, you're going to write a book with someone who's like world-renowned professor. So I agreed to that. And then we got a very lucrative contract, both in commercial sense, but also with a great publisher in US and UK. For our joint book. So we were writing a book. And then what happens is very, very soon after I declined the invitation for dinner with Stefan Halper, Professor Andrew pulls out of this book with me without any proper reason. He sort of mentioned his health, but not in any kind of, because then he'd gone and published other books, right? So nobody could really explain or understand why he would just drop out of a book contract, especially a very lucrative, very good contract. So that was that. That's 2016. But other than that, you know, it was relatively, you know, uneventful. Then the next thing that happens is I start spending less time in Cambridge because I'm pregnant by that stage. And I am 9 months pregnant. And I find out on a Saturday morning, a friend of mine sends me an email with an article attached to that, which I initially thought it was like a prank, because I see that there is a article in the Financial Times, so that's like Wall Street Journal in UK, on a Saturday with a portrait of Richard Dearlove on the front page, plus Christopher Andrew and Halper and other people from our seminar, from our little group, basically, in the middle of the article, saying that Cambridge University Intelligence Seminar has been penetrated by Kremlin spies. Yeah. And that's the front page news. And I'm like, so I honestly deleted the email because I was like, yeah, that's very funny, right? Like, okay, whatever. It's like Saturday morning. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning. He sent it to me. He lives in Asia. He was out. He's part of our group originally, and then he moved to Asia. So he sends it to me. It pings on my computer. I immediately delete it. And then when I wake up again, I pull out the article, and it's a real deal. And I just cannot understand, because you can't, it's very difficult to express just how quiet, boring, uneventful that Cambridge Intelligence Seminar was. Like, you know, Flynn presentation was probably one of the most exciting things that ever happened to us. So how this small group of retired, you know, people would be penetrated by somebody was, you know, every, you know, people like Richard Dearlove, Chris Andrew, and Halper were in their 70s. Who's going to penetrate them? So I had no idea what it was about. So I immediately called up Christopher Andrew, and we pretty much frankly laughed about it. We thought it was absolutely absurd. And we thought maybe something was happening where, you know, maybe the press just made up a story because, you know, they were bored. The only thing which concerned us is that Stefan Halper was quoted directly about his concerns about this Kremlin penetration of the group. And he specifically says that he resigned from Cambridge Intelligence Seminar in December as a result of the Russian penetration. But we knew that he actually left Cambridge Intelligence Seminar 6 months previously. And we have the email where he says that he left because he was moving back to the United States, right? And he says how much he enjoyed, we have that email, right? How much he enjoyed being a co-convener of the seminar, and he looks forward to, you know, seeing us and working with us in the future, right? There's an email about that. So we thought, well, something must have got, you know, the press must have come up with some hysterical story. So Halper must have been somehow misquoted because there's no other explanation. And so Christopher Andrew sends an email to Stefan Halper saying, you must have been misquoted. Like, what's going on? And Halper never replies. So this is December 2016. And that, remember, is, of course, just 1 month after the election in the United States. So we obviously knew that Trump won the election. We knew that somebody who once came to our seminar, you know, is being considered as national security advisor, being appointed as that. But that's it. That's how much we follow events in America. And then we have this small, nonsensical story in Britain, which starts blowing off around Christmas time, because this is December. But I received a very strange phone call from chief reporter of the Times, the Times of London. And he says to me, again, I'm nine months pregnant, and we've just dealt with this silly story from FT, which everyone just dismissed as just some kind of, you know, hysterical, you know, newspaper article. And then suddenly I get this call from the chief reporter of the Times asking, well, basically putting to me that I'm a Russian spy.
So you were the person that infiltrated the group, basically.
As it transpires, right, from this call. And I frankly was, well, I was bemused. Again, I thought that was just a, you know, hysterical sort of, you know, saying like people just say stuff. But my husband got concerned because this was like a second time now, right, that something was going on. And we, of course, again, we didn't know that there was some kind of operation, but we just knew that just maybe is like now no longer funny, right?
Yeah.
So, and it has to be stopped. So we called, this is literally nearly Christmas, I'm 9 months pregnant, so my husband calls lawyers, and we have very serious, you know, defamation libel laws in England. And the lawyer calls up the Times and said that, you know, if you publish this article, we're going to be suing you and we're going to win this case, right? Because you can't go around accusing people, you know, of being spies, right? It's just ridiculous. And remember, I'm British subject as well. And that was that. So the story never came out. Now, I asked Christopher Andrew what the hell was going on, like why, you know, what was the issue with these newspaper articles? And he explained to me that there was some kind of academic dispute between him and Halper and another person in the group because they were setting up some consultancy business or something like that. And that must have sort of somehow spilled onto newspapers, but basically to ignore it, he gave a quote to FT saying it's all absurd, to Financial Times, saying the whole thing is absurd. And that was the end of the matter as far as I was, you know, as far as I was concerned. And in any event, I was focused, you know, on my baby. She was due in January. So then the next thing that happens is my baby's born in the end of January. You know, nothing happens in January other than that, which is a huge event for me. It's my firstborn. And I'm dealing with that. And I'm dealing with, I also have to complete my book, I'm now writing on my own, and I have a deadline for that. And I'm dealing with a newborn and recovering from childbirth. And that's, we're talking now mid-February. And then the next thing that happens is on 28th of February, I start receiving a bunch of very strange emails from numerous media outlets, but from United States. And remember, I'm a completely unknown person living in United Kingdom without any connections to anyone in America. And suddenly, three top US publications, so that's Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and New York Times, contact me within 48 hours of each other. And they all have my name, my email address, and they all ask something about my relationship with General Flynn. And this is the man I met once 3 years previously. I'm sort of holding the baby, and you know, the emails come quite late at night because of the time differences, and I have no idea what's going on. Then I get this phone call from a gentleman called Professor Kent. So he's another professor within our group, and he tells me that Christopher Andrews, so this is my mentor. In the intermediate period, I forward one of the emails from Wall Street Journal about my relationship, you know, with General Flynn. I forward that to Christopher Andrew. And Christopher Andrew said, I'm so upset, I can't talk. Neil Kent, so he's another member of our group, Professor Kent, he's going to call you and tell you what's going on. I'm like, okay. And so the next thing that happens is that Neil Kent calls me up and sounds, he's another man, he's, you know, late 60s, he sounds very shaken up. And he says that he received a call from Wall Street Journal, and Wall Street Journal reporter told him that I seduced General Flynn and Christopher Andrew.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said he literally dropped his phone. He was at some event when they called up. And what is going on? And I said, precisely. So we immediately called up lawyers to say, look, this is a very strange attack. There's three newspapers. It's coordinated. They're contacting me. What do we do? And the lawyer, same lawyer, by the way, of course, who is the one who called the previous reporter, he dictated the statement for us to issue. And my husband issued the statement because I was just too unwell, saying, you know, very simply that I've only met General Flynn once. Actually, even up to today, I've only met him once in my whole life in 6 years since that dinner. And that I've only met General Flynn once, that, you know, I'm not a Russian spy. I didn't have any appropriate relationship with General Flynn or with Christopher Andrew or with anyone else, and to leave me alone because, you know, I'm having health issues, and just to stop stressing me out. And what then happens is very strange, because one of the people who gets into contact with me, so the most outrageous one is this Wall Street Journal, but the second person who got in touch with me is somebody called David Ignatius. And David Ignatius is a very prominent reporter at Washington Post. And he, we now know, was responsible for costing General Flynn his job just a few weeks earlier. But I didn't know any of that at the time, right? So what I know is I'm getting all of those emails, but Christopher Andrew told me that he was so upset with this Wall Street Journal allegation that I slept with General Flynn and with Christopher Andrew, that he said to me not to speak to any reporters. He's not going to speak to any reporters. This is outrageous. This is an outrageous attack. And then on the same day, he sends me another email saying, hey, my friend David Ignatius, says Christopher Andrew, is in town. He's a great reporter. I suggest you meet up with him. He says to a lady who is nursing a three-week-old baby and who's just been attacked in this horrible way, I suggest you meet up with this reporter from Washington Post who happens to be in Cambridge. He just flew into England from Washington. And he has inside track on General Flynn, and he wants to share it with you. And I'm like, what?
I
don't want any insight on any general. I just want to be left alone. And that was weird, right? This is my mentor of 20 years who's known me since I was 18. And who was, you know, just that same morning was literally said he can't even speak on the phone with me because he has this heart condition, and these allegations of us having an affair caused him this tremendous, you know, health problem, right? And now he's encouraging me in a very sort of positive way to meet a friend of his to discuss Jane O'Flynn. And then the email from David Ignatius himself basically says that, you know, he really wants to meet with me. And the implication of the email that is that if I meet with him and discuss Jane O'Flynn with him, then he will help me to promote my book. And he says that, you know, Christopher Andrew is a great friend of him, that that Christopher Andrew is very complimentary of me and think that I'm great. And that if I meet with him to discuss Jane O'Flynn, then he will help me in the United States because he's very, you know, prominent there to promote my book. So I'm like, that doesn't sound right. I'm just not going to meet this guy. And that's it. So I sent to him the copy of the same statement that we sent to Wall Street Journal, again, explaining that I only met Jane O'Flynn once, nothing inappropriate happened, and to leave me alone.
I just want to say real quickly, I give you a lot of credit because here you are, like, basically planting your feet on the ground, and all these really important people that have mentored you for so long are kind of like telling you to do things that you really know in your heart you shouldn't do, and you stuck to your guns anyway. Be damned the book, be damned the relationships. So I just want to give you kudos for that. Sorry about that.
That's very kind. No. That's really important because, you know, I was in a haze. I was like on painkillers after, you know, horrible sort of, you know, health complications. I'm a new mom. Literally, like, I just had a nurse, you know, coming and leaving, like, you know, minutes before those emails, like helping me, you know, I didn't know how to swaddle, you know, you have kids, how to swaddle. First time it happens, it's just such a huge thing, right? You don't know how to swaddle them.
Swaddling is hard.
Right. And everything, right? And you know, my mom wasn't around. So I was at complete loss. I was in some kind of haze. So frankly, honestly, it's almost like some kind of like crazy horror movie. Like when I try to go back to those days, I don't actually sort of remember what I felt or how it was, because I just remember sort of the baby crying, my husband trying to get on the phone with those journalists saying, like, stop, you know, because they don't stop, right? Like I send that statement over thinking it's all going to stop, and it doesn't. And what then happens is Wall Street Journal publishes a piece that says that I approached Jane. Remember, I told you the details were very important, that, you know, that I didn't know Jane O'Flynn was pre-vetted. Everyone's names were checked out, that I sat at a very specific prearranged place, that I didn't speak to Jane O'Flynn until I was asked to do so by Christopher Andrew and Richard Dilloff. All of that, right? Remember all of those details. Well, Wall Street Journal publishes an article entitled "Mike Flynn Didn't Report a Contact with a Russian British Student or Graduate," or something like that. Now, first of all, the two people who published that article, as we now know for those who've researched Spygate, are very important. So one person is called Carol Lee, and she's now with NBC, but she used to be a chief White House correspondent for Wall Street Journal and a personal friend of Obama. In fact, there are photographs of them sort of hugging at various events. That's the main person on the article. The second person on the article is Shane Harris. And Shane Harris, as you know, is basically in the mouthpiece for security services.
Yep.
So they really sent people, you know, this was an operation, right? Because they really sent very, very, you know, kind of prominent Russiagaters on me. And the article didn't make sense because this whole story, like the headline that Mike Flynn didn't report a contact from 3 years previously, like how is that news? And of course, he did report it because, you know, as we discussed at length, it was pre-vetted, right? Yeah. So DIA were copied on every communication. And then within the article, they quote, of course, anonymous sources close to. But if you read it very carefully, you can see it's Stefan Halper that they're quoting, because they say talk about, you know, former U.S. government official who has the knowledge of the 2014 dinner. And we only had one former U.S. official who had sort of knowledge.
What date did that article come out? Do you remember what month?
Well, it's a very interesting date. So the article comes out in March, I think it was the 19th. The article comes out on 19th of March, and this will become very, very important for the reason that I will explain in a minute after I research this. So this comes out on a Saturday, which is another interesting thing, right? So this is a Wall Street Journal, so business publication, right? Very obscure on Saturdays. People don't read that, right? On Saturdays, they read throughout the week. So clearly, this was the story which was being placed for the headline, and of course, it's behind the paywall. So you see the headline, which is that Mike Flynn, and remember this, so this comes out just after General Flynn has been outed. And the within this newspaper article, this American official, former government official who knew the details of the Cambridge events, i.e. Halper, says that I approached General Flynn, not true, that I sat next to General Flynn, not true. And also it goes on to basically say that he showed me some kind of attention. Now, what's interesting about that is that Halper wasn't at dinner, but the way that the article is written is as if he was. And then the article talks about how intelligence services are using this kind of approaches, like the one that I made, in order to compromise Americans, senior Americans. And the other thing it says there is that it refers to an article by my own professor, Christopher Andrew. And I didn't know about this article until the Wall Street Journal article comes out, because it then transpires that only 2 weeks previously, Christopher Andrew, my own mentor of 20 years, published an article. He didn't tell me about that. And he didn't name me by my name, so I didn't know that until the Wall Street Journal article came out that he did that, where he said that General Flynn showed attention to me and that he invited me to Moscow to act as a translator for him, and that he was very taken by me and that I showed him an erotic postcard. None of that happened. All of this are complete lies. This is from my own mentor. And then they quote this article in the Wall Street Journal article. They say, well, the woman is not named, but there was only this one woman. Therefore, it's Svetlana Lukova. So they put my name. And then they also say that this contact between me and Flynn is part of the counterintelligence investigation into General Flynn. So, and I'm like, what?
So now you're in the you're a Russian spy in the middle of compromising the former DIA of the United States of America. But at the same, when did Christopher Andrew write the article they referenced?
So the article came out 2 weeks previously. So that would be in the end of February. But he never told me, right? So I find out that from the Wall Street Journal article,
right,
that he wrote that article. But he, and when I later asked him about this article, because when I moved on to litigation against the newspapers, of course, this was one of the things that were untrue about me. He told me that he was under enormous pressure to write that article, and this was in the London Times, but he wouldn't explain what the pressure was.
So, and that before or after he had told you to meet with Ignatius?
Right. That was literally within days of him encouraging me to. Well, it was before, but it was very, very close date.
Yep.
And of course, if we, now that we know that we researched the subject, now we know what actually happens is, you know, remember at that stage, I'm just this mom in the middle of a storm having no idea where they're coming from. But now we know from research that what actually was happening is around the inauguration time, Director of National Intelligence Clapper gave an order to Ignatius to take a kill shot on General Flynn. And Ignatius published an article just a few weeks before he came to see me in England. He published an article where he published the leaked conversation between General Flynn, and who was National Security Advisor at the time, and Ambassador Kislyak. And the person, according to General Flynn's lawyer, the person who leaked that tape to Ignatius was his friend James Baker of the Office of Net Assessment, who is the person who gave Stefan Halper all the contracts. So this is a very closely knit group. And so the kill shot on Flynn, we now know, consisted of two crucial parts. One was to remove him as national security advisor, right? Which is how Ignatius published that article. So this is in February. And then at the end of February, this rather elderly man gets on the airplane from Washington to England to meet me and publish an article about me. So that's the second part of the kill shot. And the rest of the articles were around that, right? So that, and the Christopher Andrew article is clearly part of the kill shot on General Flynn.
So it was a bunch of media posturing at that point, and obviously a Christopher Andrew who they had something on, I would assume, in order to get him to do something like this. Have you had any conversations with him since? And how did that make you feel after that long of a time working so closely with somebody?
Well, so the in terms of what they had on him is he was genuinely shocked when he ended up in newspapers. You know, that December 2016 article where a Cambridge intelligence seminar that he created was penetrated by Russian spies. And my understanding is, in effect, they were going to ruin his career, right? Because they made him look like either he's a Russian asset himself by being close to me, or he's a fool, right? But because he worked closely with me for 20 years, he introduced me to very important people within UK and US intelligence community, you know, such as General Flynn. So therefore, he was somebody who was in effect.
We lost her.
He never explained anything to me. But when he said about the pressure.
No, we lost you for just a second, but keep going.
Right. So my understanding from his perspective, he never told me that. But when they placed him, his photograph in a newspaper and associated him with Russian espionage, he had to sort of condemn me somehow, because otherwise he would be, you know, corroborating with a Russian spy. That is probably how they got to him.
There goes the integrity right out the window.
Right. Right. And so he... but he wouldn't tell me. That's the thing, right? Some numerous friend of ours tried, everyone, including his own friends, condemned that article because it was not true. In fact, what was very interesting is the person, so you remember that I had on the left of me, I had somebody called, on the left of me, I had Richard Dearlove sitting next to me. But on the right of me, I had somebody called Bill Foster, Dr. Bill Foster, who is one of the other senior members of our group, sitting next to me on the right. And he too took that Christopher Andrew article to his friend, Stefan Halper, and said to him that this article is not true. None of that happened. He sat next to me. Bill Foster sat next to me. And Halper, of course, wasn't at dinner. And Halper apparently got very agitated about that, because the attempts were being made to clear my name, but apparently Halper stopped it. And we now know why, because he was the one who placed those stories into the newspapers in the first place. For me, the Chris Andrew thing is probably one of the most hurtful aspects of this whole story, because just a day before he was pushing me to meet Ignatius, he was asking for my newborn baby's photograph. Right, which I sent to him. When I came from Russia to England at the tender age of 18, I hardly knew anyone. You know, most of my family, including my mom, you know, stayed back in Russia. And he became almost, well, I wouldn't say a parent, right? But he became somebody very close to me, who mentored me through my Cambridge academic career and through my new way of life in England. So as a, for instance, he would often invite me to his house. You know, I know his wife, I know his kids and grandkids. He has, you know, very big, wonderful family. And on the other side is, like, as his health became, you know, deteriorated with old age, you know, I often, you know, helped him out, helped them out to sort things out, because I was there in Cambridge and his family was far away. So this was, I wouldn't say sort of members of the family type relationship, very close, very personal, right? And so it's somebody I worked with professionally for many years, but somebody also who I considered, you know, very, very close friend. So frankly, I still to this day, you know, it's very difficult to recover from that, because I now have to go back through 20 years of my life and remember each occasion that I met with him or anyone else within this Cambridge group, and reconsider, like, were they spying on me? Were they, you know, like, basically this whole thing becomes now a lie. Right. So it's something that I've invested so much, which is in my academic career, but also in my relationship at Cambridge, now all been, you know, just destroyed. So that's very sad for me. And, you know, I'm pretty tough, but that's something which I think hit me quite hard, harder than I thought. But then the next thing that happens is that at the same time as the as this Wall Street Journal article comes out, another article comes out. And this is by somebody called Luke Harding. And Luke Harding is works for the Guardian newspaper in the United Kingdom. And Luke Harding is very closely associated with Christopher Steele. So he's his de facto spokesman. And Luke Harding publishes this article entitled "Mike Flynn, New Evidence Suggests That UK and US Spy Chiefs Had Concerns About His Russia Contact, Including Contact with a Woman, Svetlana Lukova." So again, they put my name and my picture in the newspapers. And this Luke Harding contacted, prior to publication, Christopher Andrew. He didn't contact me. And he put to Christopher Andrew that I'm this Russian spy. And he specifically said that the reason why he's going to put in the newspaper that I'm this Russian spy is because I had access to archival documents on Soviet espionage. Christopher Andrew responded to him, I have a copy of this email, saying that this is absolutely absurd because he, Christopher Andrew, has seen all my research. And in fact, those same documents are quoted in numerous academic articles that I published. And if Luke Harding wants to find out where those documents come from, which is from Open Digital Archive,
right?
You know, he should buy, you know, or go to the library, he said, Chris Andrew says to Harding, get a copy of her articles, and you will see she quotes the documents. So Christopher Andrew, I have a copy of that email, specifically tells Harding that it's a conspiracy theory that Putin gave me documents because I work for Putin, right?
So at the same time as Christopher Andrew is kind of selling you out on one hand, he's also defending you privately on the other.
Well, what he did is, and again, he never told me what he was up to other than he was under a lot of pressure. But my understanding is, just from analyzing what happened, is the article that he did about General Flynn, he considered to be an attack on him, not on me. So he said it was General Flynn who showed interest in me. He didn't say that I seduced General Flynn, which is what the newspaper said. He said General Flynn was attracted to me. He said General Flynn invited me to Moscow. He said that General Flynn, you know, so everything was about General Flynn. So from his perspective, is my understanding, is like, why are you complaining? This was an attack on Flynn, right?
Yeah, they just wanted to use your name.
Right.
They wanted you to be comfortable with them using your name to hit him.
That's exactly that. So when that's exactly the same thing happened when my husband called up Wall Street Journal in the middle of the night and started, you know, my husband, first time I ever heard him swearing, he said, why did you put my wife's name, you know, into this article? We don't care about US politics, but why are you dragging my wife into it? And he kept being told the same thing, which is, it's not about her, it's about General Flynn. So the point about this is that anything that my husband tried to tell them, so for example, that, you know, Lukova did not sit next to General Flynn. Here are the photographs. They disregard. Lukova did not approach, Svetlana didn't approach General Flynn because, you know, we know that she was invited to that dinner. They disregard. So even the most minute details that my husband and others who were present at dinner, they've written in, they tried to correct. They refused. Wall Street Journal refused to correct them and Guardian refused to correct them, right? So that tells you the story was pre-written. It didn't matter what you said. And even my husband said that he knows who the source is. So we knew that Halper was the source because remember I told you that Chris Andrew told me that they had this falling out. And that I was basically, I was told that I was being attacked as a result of being close to Christopher Andrew. So we didn't know it was an intelligence operation, but we knew Stefan Halper was a source.
Yeah.
And so my husband told them, and even in emails, that he knows who the source is and their source is acting maliciously. We, of course, by that meant maliciously against Christopher Andrew. But, and I'm just a victim of that. But they still would not change even the most minute details, such as who sat next to whom, which you know, you'd think if you were not invested in the story, you'd change as a journalist, right?
Especially why would you care when there so much? Are pictures available.
Right, exactly. And then other people have written in saying we were at dinner. Like, this is where what happened. And they still would ignore that, right? And the same happened with this Guardian article, where no matter what you say, they stuck to that story. And that's it, right? So what this story actually said, we now know, is the reason for the December 2016 article, which later then gets repeated in March, April 2017, is when Flynn gets appointed. You know, when I was being approached as a, you know, being accused of being a Russian spy in December, that's when Halper starts spreading those lies. And we know now why, because that's in the Guardian article, where when Flynn was being appointed as national security advisor by Trump, they wanted to stop that, right? Because remember that for the whole year, they were actually spying on the campaign. So remember the January 2016 approach by Halper, we now know he wanted to meet with me because he wanted to organize surveillance on General Flynn. And that's how he started sending in reports that I'm this Russian spy, right? Then, of course, this is January 2016. And then, of course, remember that we now know that in July 2016, he, of course, tries to entrap and succeeds to an extent Carter Page. Right. Yep. We now also, of course, know that in September he entraps Papadopoulos. So that whole 2016 is they were spying and setting up the Trump campaign. So they know that Flynn, when he becomes NSA in December, right, he will find all of that out, that they spied on him, that they spied on Trump through the campaign, and also that they were trying to swing the election, right? And of course, Flynn was a threat to them anyway, right? Because he wanted to reduce the use of outside contractors, the budget. He wanted to look into, you know, what's the point of, you know, CIA at that current form? So he was a huge threat to the intelligence services. But then on top of that, he was going to find out, and Trump was going to find out how they tried to spy on both of them and how they tried to swing the election. So they had to pull out all the stops to prevent Flynn from being appointed NSA. So what they did is they placed those articles in the newspapers because they wanted to scare Trump from appointing Flynn as his national security advisor by claiming that he's this Russian asset. But Trump ignored it, as he does. And then what happens is once they got rid of Flynn, right, the second media attack, which is the one we've just gone through with Ignatius and with Andrew and with New York Times and with Guardian, that second attack, so this is the March-April attack, that's after, this is very important, Tracy, that you ask about the date, because I know dates, because I know, you know, you have this attention to details. The dates are crucial because the dates match the testimony of Comey in March, right? And planned testimony of Clapper and Brennan. So Brennan and Clapper were meant to testify in the and Sally Yates, they were meant to testify to Congress in the end of March. And that's the timing of one of the first coups against the now elected president. Because what they were placing into the newspapers to scare the Congress, right, they were placing the stories to show that Trump appointed as national security advisor, so the person in charge of your national security, he appointed a known Russian asset, and that the intelligence services warned Trump about it, and he disregarded those warnings. That was the purpose we now know of those articles. And because that didn't happen, because Flynn is not a Russian asset, because he's never been recruited by any Russians, they had to invent it. Wow. Right. And I was the tool to invent this recruitment of General Flynn. Now, the March testimony doesn't happen because it gets postponed. But the articles were already pre-written. So the articles go out to match Brennan testimony, because the Brennan testimony happens in May. And if you read it very closely, he talks about a senior Russian, a senior Trump campaign advisor being blackmailed by the Russians. And he gets asked, who is the name of that person? He said, I can't say that in open settings, but on this, in the open setting. But on the same day, Washington Post says he was referring to Michael Flynn. So the purpose of the articles naming Flynn as a Russian asset because of my recruitment of him, they say, was to match the brand and testimony to Congress so people know who he's talking about. And that was to impeach the president, because they knew that, you know, remember Flynn had, by that stage, has been investigated for nearly a year by the FBI. And we now know from Sidney Powell, so that's Flynn's attorney, filings that on January 30th, before he formally started his duties as national security advisor,
they knew he had wasn't.
So FBI gave a document to DOJ on January the 30th. So they knew he wasn't a Russian asset, but they went to Congress with it, because remember, in those days, of course, Congress was not controlled by the Democrats. It was controlled by Republicans. So they couldn't impeach him. You know, they always were going to impeach Trump, right? Like, that was the plan from day one, but they couldn't impeach them because they didn't have Congress. So what they had to do is they had to basically do a Nixon, right, on Trump, which is that, remember that people think, you know, Nixon was impeached. Actually, the Republicans went to, you know, Gerald Ford went to Nixon, and he said, you better leave. And Nixon did, right, because it's too much scandal around you. And that's what they were trying to do to Trump. And that was the purpose. Now, luckily for Trump, David Nunes postponed the Brennan testimony. So the Brennan testimony originally was going to take place in March. But because there was too much going on, it got postponed. And Adam Schiff got very, very upset about that. We now know why, right? Because all these articles were ready to surround Brennan and Comey and Clapper testimony. But the Brennan testimony got postponed. So imagine if in March, when the transitional team is still very much, you know, it's very messy, and, you know, Trump then goes on to, you know, fire Comey, saying, you know, Comey makes it look as if he fired him because of Michael Flynn, which is not true. And then if on top of that, Brennan and Clapper and Sally Yates said all these things about Flynn being, you know, compromised and blackmailed by this Russian spy, and we told this to the president and he's disregarded it. If all of those testimonies happened in March, there could have been a chance that maybe Republicans would have been shaken up, and maybe, you know, maybe
that early, especially. Yep.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that people don't realize. So now we got your story, right, of how this happened to you. But there's a part two to this, and I really do want to have you back for it, because when you're involved in something like this, and you're obviously a brilliant academic researcher like you, you have a little bit more of a personal interest in figuring out what the hell happened. So not only do you have this wealth of knowledge about history, and you have all the details and facts straight about what happened to you, but I'm sure you went to unpeel the onion and figure out what the hell was going on. So now you've got this breadth of this Spygate knowledge that you're putting all together.
Well, that's right, because remember that, you know, I had have nothing else in my life now other than my family, because what then happens is that, you know, I was very highly regarded at Cambridge University. I was building, you know, very good, you know, academic career where I was teaching students, and I was very popular. You know, I have all the written, you know, feedback from students. So in fact, it was, you know, they were overwhelming me with teaching and research and inviting me to things. So I had a very, very busy life at Cambridge, and it was only getting, you know, better and better. And then suddenly everything dried up. Right.
Yeah.
And but they wouldn't tell me. Right. They wouldn't tell me. Cambridge wouldn't tell me what was going on. It just became weird. Like, people sort of stopped returning my calls and emails without any explanation. And then I bumped into somebody, literally bumped into on the street, somebody, another person I've known, you know, for 20 years. And I wave at him, and he pretends he doesn't see me. Right. So I literally kind of stop, you know, he's on the bike, so I kind of stop in front of the bike saying, can you not see me? Like, you know, hello.
Yeah. Why are you
and
ignoring
he says,
me?
Yeah. And he says, I can't be speaking to you because Putin will find out.
Oh my gosh.
And goes off on the bike. And he's a professor. I'm not going to name him, but he's a very well-known professor. So what Halper did, remember, Halper was very influential around Cambridge. So he and people have since come forward to tell me precisely what Halper did, because remember, Halper arrived at Cambridge University with $1 million that you American taxpayers unfortunately gave him, as well as the FBI money, which is undisclosed amounts. But we know that he got paid $1 million. Now, $1 million in Cambridge is a lot of money, right? So he buys his way into the university system. He donates a lot of money to Magdalen College, where he's a life fellow, which is the college where he invites Carter Page to lure him into. And he goes around Cambridge with influence, right? So then he goes, and also he's somebody who, you know, claims that he was a senior figure in numerous presidential administrations and somebody very important. So he went around Cambridge spreading those lies about me as part of his operation against Trump and Flynn, which meant that people took it seriously. So one example is Bill Foster. That's the man that I told you was sitting next to me at dinner. He was the one who gave me, for example, a lot of teaching opportunities. And then he started, and he used to then what was very strange is he started taking me out for lunch very regularly, which kind of doesn't happen in Cambridge because all these academics are poor, right? So you eat in the canteen. And he took me to nice restaurants a few times and asked me about my research and what I was up to. And I couldn't understand what it was. But then when Halper gets outed as a spy, Bill Foster comes forward to me and says that actually he now realizes that he was spying for Halper on me. But it wasn't just spying. It was that Halper was putting things into people's heads. That Svetlana, oh, she's very suspicious. How could she have got hold of all these documents, all of this research? It had to be something like Putin helped her or something like that, right? And he kind of went dripping that poison around the university. And people then now feel that they got taken in by him. But it's a bit too late. And the only time that Bill Foster realized that something really bad was happening is when that article by Christopher Andrew came out and he tried to challenge it and Halper got very upset. Mm. And we know from, you know, from what he did to Papadopoulos and Page, how upset he gets and agitated when things don't go his way. But in the meantime, you know, they now erased his Halper's profile from Cambridge University, but they won't give him my job back. So I've written to Vice Chancellor, I demanded of Cambridge University, I've demanded an investigation, and they just ignore me. Oh, so gosh. They basically kicked me out of Cambridge without any explanation, and then they just closed ranks, and that's it. So from my perspective, it's very sad because my academic career, basically at Cambridge as it is now over, which is a shame because I worked very hard for it. And everyone now knows that Halper was a bad one, but nobody wants a scandal, right? And so it puts me into this horrible position where I lost everything I worked all my life for. And that's how I came to research for the last pretty much 3 years. All I've been doing is trying to get my name back, my good name back, my academic standing back. So I don't want to be considered as some kind of traitor, seductress, spy, right? For working for foreign power. I want my normal life back. And that's what I've been fighting for. And then, of course, in May 2018, it then got reported that Halper is a spy. Because remember, I always knew that Halper was a source for all this malicious lies in the newspapers. But I was told that this was part of an academic dispute between him and my mentor. Then, of course, once we find out that he was a CIA asset and FBI asset out of Cambridge, and that he was involved in this whole Russiagate hoax, then, of course, we know now that this was part of an operation. And so since then, I've been trying to, you know, get the story out there, both in terms of what happened to me personally, which is horrific, but also what him and other members of what Devin Nunes calls Cambridge Club have done to your country.
And so you've written a book, which is on pre-order. Tell everyone about that because I pre-ordered it myself. I can't wait for it. So tell everyone about how the book came about and how they can purchase it.
I really appreciate it. So the book is called The Spider, Stefan A. Halper and the Dark Web of the Coup. So the spider, the central character in this book is this man, Stefan Halper, who is this aged American dirty trickster masquerading at my university as a professor. And he spends the whole of 2016 and to an extent 17 luring members of the Trump team And they end up in his spider net, right? So, of course, his first victim is General Flynn, because he's responsible for organizing counterintelligence investigation into General Flynn by claiming that I seduced General Flynn on behalf of Putin. And of course, then so General Flynn and I become the victim. So I lose everything as a result of Halper's activities. Then he moves on to, to entrap Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. And then, of course, he ends up, trying to unseat President Trump. And he's responsible, also remember, on top of everything else, he's responsible for providing, Halper is responsible for providing false information that he attributes to former head of SVR. Remember that at the beginning of the conversation, I said how, although he claimed that, Halper claimed that Cambridge University was penetrated by Russian intelligence, the only person who ever invited Russian intelligence, or rather former Russian intelligence officer, was him. So he invited somebody called Trubnikov, who was the former head of SVR. And then he attributed to Trubnikov that Trump has been cultivated by Putin. So not only he attacked General Flynn, as if that wasn't enough, General Flynn, Carter Page, and Papadopoulos and me, but he also actually took, he's responsible for the most outrageous allegation against the president. So he literally is a spider. And that's why the book is called that, because he's somebody who wanted to, destroy everyone's lives. And you can buy it on Amazon, and it's available for pre-order now, The Spider by Svetlana Lukova.
Yeah, everybody needs to get the book and support, not only get your story out there, but support you as well. And I have a feeling like as this starts winding down, we're 3 or 4 years into it now, people like you are going to be reestablished by good folks everywhere and be able to have other opportunities. But this interim period really just sucks in plain English. So
it absolutely sucks. And I'm telling you, I'm pretty tough. I've, been through a very, very hard life. But I think this really is a horrible situation, because here you are a regular person, nobody important. And if they can do this to you, who am I? I'm just some woman. I'm some random woman. They don't care about me, right? It wasn't an attack on me, right? They had this big political game. But in the process, think about, just for 1 second, what they're actually doing to all of you, right? They get to decide who's going to be your president, right? You can't decide that. They're going to decide it for you. And in the process of taking that decision, right, that they're going to install their president, and if you vote in the wrong way to them, then they're just going to remove that president, because that's what they can, right? That's what they're doing.
And thankfully, they haven't been successful.
Exactly. Luckily, right? But they've been trying pretty hard for the last, over 3 years. But in the process, they don't care whom they hurt. They don't care about the individuals. They don't care about their families. And that's what's so scary about that, is they can absolutely ruin your life and not even think about it. And so far, unfortunately, there hasn't been any accountability for them. Hopefully, we know that attorney from Connecticut, Durham, obviously now made this into a criminal investigation, which hopefully means that he has enough for that. And one of the aspects he was looking into, which was reported, is Stephen Halper's big payments from Pentagon, which have been described in the press as payments from CIA slash funds. And those payments match crucial events in Spygate. So Senator Grassley has also been looking into that. And he found out that, I'm covering that in my book as well, that every time there's an important event in Spygate, such as attack on General Flynn, luring of Papadopoulos a page, and of course, attack on President Trump, Halper gets a huge amount of money for what he says is academic research, but he hasn't submitted the research he said he did. But he gets nearly $1 million.
I've been reading some of the FOIA releases on Halper, and he papers about elephants and, just things that he was critiqued, as a matter of fact, in his rating from Net Assessment and the money he was getting because of the kind of crap he was giving back in. So, it's really just a big money laundering operation. And
it is. And, people often ask me, and it's very amusing. So if you read the IG report, they're still protecting him. That's another thing, right? So it's okay for General Flynn name to be, through the mud, my name, President Trump, you know, being a Russian puppet. They say that all the time. I'm the seductress. Well, you know, right? Everyone's name's been in the newspapers, but not the people who actually did that. So, for example, Halper, he's still only called at a source two in the IG report. They still wouldn't even put his name. Right? Because what they've done very cleverly, he's just a dirty trickster, right? But by making him into confidential human source, it's a bit like this whistleblower story, right? Where you take a wrongdoer, you give him legal protection, and then nobody's allowed to mention him because otherwise you pose risks to lives and sources and methods and operations, right? So he's, you know, so far been getting away with it. But if you read the IG report, and you know that Halper is source two, they describe that it was serendipitous that Halper knew all of the targets of the Crossfire Hurricane, so that's the Russian investigation, knew all of them.
Yes.
And they said that the agents couldn't believe their luck.
Uh-huh.
But then, of course, by that stage, Halper got paid nearly $1 million, and he has been, you know, speaking of money laundering, right, he has placed the evidence, the crumbs, and then the FBI sends him to investigate the very people
that he had played. Yeah,
exactly, right. And then, of course, you consider the fact that, you know, they start telling you the story about Papadopoulos and 31st of July and Downer and WikiLeaks and all of that, right? And even if for 1 second you believe it, which of course nobody does, but even for 1 second you believe it, that's July 2016. So what was Halper doing in December 2015, January 2016, spying on Michael Flynn? If the Russian investigation started as a result of some drunk conversation by Papadopoulos, which is what they lead you to believe.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, you won't see my story in the mainstream press, because I break through that chronology, right? Because they want you to think everything starts in July, because they made up some kind of nonsense predicate for the July 2016 origination date, right? But once you realize that their first victim was General Flynn and me, and that happened in January 2016 or December 2015, as David Nunes tells us all the time, that the spying, the operation against the Trump campaign started in December 2015. Once you accept that, then it completely breaks through their chronology, because that means that they had no predicate, because there were no Hillary emails or DNC emails. There was no Papadopoulos in December 2015. And what? Why were they allowed? Why was CIA and FBI allowed to spy on an American general senior campaign advisor in December 2015? And that gets them then into a huge amount of trouble. And that's why my story is so important, because my story breaks through their chronology. That's why the fact that I came forward is so important. The second reason why it's so important is because David Nunes was very clear, just, you know, at the SIPA conference that you and I just recently attended and where we met, where he explained the importance of the Cambridge Club. So what he said is that the original information we were being all told came from Britain, right? But David Nunes said very clear that that information wasn't official. Because there's something called Five Eyes, which is a cooperation intelligence sharing agreement between the five countries, such as Britain and the United States. And every document that comes from this official channel will have the Five Eyes marking on it. But that makes it open to scrutiny by Congress, i.e. people like David Nunes. Because Nunes is, of course, was the head of the intelligence committee, and now he's a ranking member. So any official intelligence they could have looked into. And remember, Nunes tells us there was no official intelligence for the start of this operation. They didn't have anything. There was no reason to start it, right? So how did they go around it? Well, they went around this by using what Nunes calls rumor intelligence. So you know there's usually humans, which is human intelligence, human sources. SIGINT, which is signals, that's right. So that's intercepts and emails and things like that. They didn't have any of that. They didn't have any predicate. So the only thing they had is, quote-unquote, predicate, is a rumor. And they didn't want to put them through the official channels, because this would immediately be blown apart by Nunes and his team. And that's how they use the so-called Cambridge Club as Ninush calls it. So that's people like Halper, Dilav, Andrew, Shragi is another interesting character. So this is this American who invites Carter Page to Cambridge, and he actually, funny enough, you know, happened to sit next to you pretty much at the CPAC event. So he came to that. But he's somebody who, you know, is responsible for, you know, he was pretending to be a student under Stefan Halper in Cambridge, but he's somehow involved in operation against Carter Page, at least, maybe others. So all of these members of this Cambridge group, they were sitting there in Britain at Cambridge University, using that as a cover, right? And they were writing fake stories, and then they would feed those rumors into the official DOJ and FBI system, circumventing any kind of oversight.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so that's why what happened in Cambridge, what happened to me, is really, really important for all of you, because it will get you to the origins.
And we're glad that you sat with us, you know, today to tell us all this stuff. I want to have you back on again, because I have a bunch more questions. But thanks for this today. And yes, you're right. He did sit right next to me, right in the front row, watching you as you were giving your presentation with John Batchelor and the others on the stage.
And that's what's so scary, right? Is that there's, you know, Shragi was somebody who's like very, he has a very strange role in all of this, because he's somebody who says that he's a student of Stefan Halper. But why would you be learning about American politics in England, in Cambridge? And this guy is pretty senior. You know, he was deputy assistant secretary of state. He was also the man who worked on Mitt Romney campaign and introduced Kofa Black, who is a very close associate of CIA's Brennan. You know, he's a member of CSIS, which is a known CIA think tank. So this is a pretty senior guy, Stephen Shragi. He ends up in Cambridge University pretending to be this lowly student, but for some reason he's so lowly that he personally knows Madeleine Albright, with whom he has this panel where Carter Page is invited to, right? He's the one responsible for inviting Carter Page, and then of course they use that contact to, you know, set up a lot of Spygate events. And yet, you know, he never comes forward until now. And then now, 3 years later, he somehow finds out that I'm speaking at this Russiagate panel at the CPAC, literally, what is it, 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
And he shows up and he sits in third row, where you, I think, were sitting in the first or second row. And then Michael Flynn Jr., so Flynn's son, was there. And this man shows up. You know, I don't know whether he was trying to intimidate me, which clearly didn't succeed, or he was spying on me, wanted to know what I'm going to tell. But it's very interesting, because rather than going to the DOJ office or FBI office, which is where he should go if he has something to say, he comes to CPAC.
Yeah.
To spy on people. So basically, this is continuing today. This is what's so very, very scary about this whole story, is they still haven't stopped yet.
No, the media keeps going too. Svetlana, this was really fantastic. I'm really glad we got to connect, because now we can bounce things off one another, which I'm sure we'll be doing a whole hell of a lot of.
Right.
And, you know,
and I think it's very important to have people like you to shine the lights on this and do this every day. And I think for all of us, it's very, you know, it's tiresome, because it just goes on and on for many, many. I mean, for me personally, it's been a nightmare, but it's also, you know, it's been a very long period of time. But I think it's very important to just have, you know, to persist. It's every day, you know, you tweet, you put a, you know, social media post there. Every day you're shining light on them. And sun, as we know, is the best disinfectant. So, you know, very grateful for people like you, Tracy, to be out there and remind people how important this story is, because the coup is continuing today.
It sure is. It sure is. Thanks for those kind words. I really like you a lot, by the way. And you're funny and you're sweet and you're just a great person. So it was really good to spend some time with you. And thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, my honor. Thank you so much.
And there you have it. And there you have it.
We could have put that into three volumes.
For sure.
Amazing.
For sure. And I almost didn't know how to end it, but I'm not going to keep anybody any longer. So you've been listening to the Dark to Light podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums and
Ms. Beans. You can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2:30 Eastern Time on TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and RadioInfluence.com. We'll see you Wednesday.
Later.
I'm Jerry P. Tuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.